By this summer, the war in Ukraine that began when Russia invaded that country will have lasted as long as the First World War, which was certainly not what Vladimir Putin expected when he gave the order to attack, or what other countries predicted once that assault began. In that time, the narrative and expectations of the war have continually shifted, as has the position of Ukraine's key allies, especially the United States. So as winter ends in Ukraine, what are its prospects now? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. I'm joined by four experts. Mark Galeotti, who's head of MIAC Intelligence and author of Forged in War, A Military History of Russia. Dr. Jack Watling, who's Senior Research Fellow for Land Warfare at the Royal United Services Institute, and he's the author of The Arms of the Future. Rebecca Lister, who's a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former National Security Advisor in the Biden administration. And Christopher Miller, the Financial Times Chief Ukraine Correspondent and author of The War Came to Us, Life and Death in Ukraine. Chris Miller, if I can begin with you. We last had you on the programme back at the end of November, beginning of December, and then things were looking rather gloomy for Ukraine. There was that corruption scandal you told us about. Russia seemed to be making steady, if rather slow, progress on the battlefield, and the Trump administration, critically, seemed to be backing that 28-point plan for a peace that seemed massively favourable to Russia. So my first question is, in summary, what's changed for Ukraine since then?
You know, the last time we spoke was the start of winter. We're coming out of winter now and about ready to enter spring, although it's snowing right now. But Ukraine made it through the winter. It did not face a catastrophic collapse. It came close to it at several points with these relentless Russian missile and drone attacks. The Russians have slowed their offensive on the ground in the east, but they've really stepped up these aerial strikes. The Ukrainians right now have managed to also counter a bit in some spots along the front line. But I wouldn't go as far as to call it a full-blown counteroffensive. Really, neither side has a whole lot of momentum going into spring, and I think that's interesting. On the peace talk front, you know, Donald Trump has himself sort of backed away from the 28-point peace plan that certainly favored Moscow. But we're still locked in these negotiations that appear to be going nowhere, really, except for in the direction where the Ukrainians are still under a lot of pressure from the United States to bring this war to an end on terms that appear still favorable to Russia.
Chris, very quickly, what happened to the corruption scandal? Did it cease to be a problem for Zelensky?
No, actually, it's deepened in a way. It's not necessarily on the forefront of everybody's mind at the moment because winter has been so horrific for people here without power and electricity. But we've seen new charges brought against some of those previously investigated. We've seen some new cases opened by the independent anti-corruption bodies into those people close to President Zelensky or formerly in his inner circle. So that's still very much an issue.
Mark Galeotti, now let's look at Russia. What, as far as you can see, has changed for Russia since the end of November?
Well, the blunt answer is really not a lot. In terms of the actual fighting, the Russians have taken some territory, the Ukrainians have taken a little bit of territory back, but nothing that really is dramatically shifting the needle. The economy has continued its slow slide into recession, depression, maybe even stagnation. And politically, we see Putin really not indicating any particular change in his position, both in terms of the negotiations. He's still demanding this 20% of Donetsk region that hasn't been conquered as his price for peace. And also domestically, we're not really seeing any change in the line.
Jack Watling, let's look at what's happened on the battlefields over the course of the winters.
Over the course of 2024 and 2025, both armies became much more proficient in finding each other and striking each other accurately, whether with artillery or with drones, primarily with drones. And over the summer, the Russians had shifted to infiltration tactics, using the dense vegetation in what is now wasteland, essentially, to work their way through the Ukrainian fighting positions because the Ukrainian units were quite short of troops. As that vegetation died back, you could see people from much further away. And so the Russians have been taking more losses. They have not really been making that much progress. And at the same time, the Russians are not replacing their losses as easily as they were before. the Russians really face a challenge, which is, do they just keep grinding away with their current tactics, even though the efficacy of those tactics is diminishing, or do they change how they operate? We have no indication at the moment that the Kremlin, noting that there's always a lag between change on the battlefield and things being reported to Putin, is directing things to shift. On the Ukrainian side, the Ukrainians have been studying the problem of how to conduct attacks in this very transparent, lethal battle space. And some of their units, the units that have not been committed on the front line as intensively, have had the time and space to train and practice and have now validated certain tactics that have allowed the Ukrainians to counterattack very successfully in Kupiansk and also in the south. But these are very, very small tactical actions. And the question for the Ukrainians at this point is, can they somehow replicate those tactical successes on a broader front by laterally training the force?
Rebecca Listener, now let's talk about what's changed, if anything, in America. What are you hearing in the US about the administration's understanding of how things are going?
Well, since the November-December timeline, we've seen what has become, frankly, a familiar cycle in U.S. policy towards Ukraine, where, as Chris indicated, we went from the Trump administration seeming to give its full endorsement to a 28-point plan that was developed together with the Russians and initially presented as a best and final offer that Zelensky had to either accept or not and face the consequences. But then through a series of diplomatic interventions and I would say internal wrangling within the Trump administration, that initial 28-point plan was walked back. There was a new plan put forward that was more aligned with what the Ukrainians and Europeans wanted to see. Neither of those plans became a plan that was acceptable to all the parties in negotiation. And so now we're back to an open-ended phase of diplomacy where the hardest issues, such as territory, remain unresolved and on the table. The other important aspect of the past few months, of course, has been that these twists and turns in America's Ukraine policy have happened against the backdrop of an incredibly dramatic period in transatlantic relations, in which the president threatened to invade Greenland, the semi-autonomous territory of a NATO ally, Denmark, using force, causing European allies to question not only the United States' commitment to Ukraine, but its commitment to European security and transatlantic alliance itself. So all of that is to say that the bottom line for the Trump administration just hasn't changed. President Trump wants to see an end to this war. He said that again in his State of the Union address just recently.
Let's talk a bit more about the war and the technology itself. And first, Chris Miller, you've written about drone warfare for the FT, and you've actually gone and had a look at it happening. Can you talk a bit about that and what you've seen?
There's really no element of the war that hasn't been impacted by the development of these military drones and surveillance drones, reconnaissance drones, including, you know, aerial drones, sea drones, these new ground drones as well. You know, they command the battlefield. They dictate movement well beyond the front line. So in fact, you know, what we think of as the front line has been dramatically changed because of all of these drones. The soldiers now refer to the battlefront as not a front line, but as a kill zone. So it's the sort of area that extends upwards of 20 to 30 kilometers in both directions, which of course is, you know, about the distance that an FPV or a first-person drone and fiber optic drones are able to fly. And so anything in this area that moves is going to likely be killed or destroyed or damaged. And, you know, entire highways and roads are now covered in fishing nets to stop these small FPV drones. I saw all of this just over the weekend. So what this means is the war's been sort of pushed, at least the soldiers have been pushed underground. So it's rare to now see soldiers exposed and out of their entrenched positions within the kill zone.
Can you just very briefly explain what a fiber optic drone is?
It's this hair thin cable that is attached to the back end of a drone and then the launch point, essentially. And really the only way that it can be stopped is to clip that line or to bring it down by, say, shotgun or some other method.
Jack Watling, could you take us a little bit further into this drone competition and any other ways in which the battlefield is altering?
Most of the technology we're seeing was in existence in the 1980s. You know, it's not new stuff. But it has entered scaled production and widespread adoption, essentially, by the troops. And it creates a very persistent problem, which is that you are observed across a very, very wide area. And that means that an adversary has a long time to be able to direct that something should come and kill you. And you have to get all the way across that distance before you're actually making any change to who controls what terrain or what terrain is denied. And everyone could kind of, in the military space, could kind of see this problem emerging long before the war in Ukraine. Until it manifests, which it now has, you can't really get to the next stage, which is experimenting on how do we overcome this problem. And on the Ukrainian side, that's why the operation in Kupiansk in the autumn was so important, because the Ukrainians showed how not only using drones, but using drones in combination with other tools, you could actually take control of the battle space over a certain area, and that would allow you to move.
Mark Galeotti, what Jack is suggesting is the Ukrainians have been pretty good at adapting at scale to the technologies which may have been available for some time, but they're actually managing to use them probably. Is it too crude to see the Russians as always lagging behind that capacity of innovation, or do they eventually catch up?
The thing is, what the Russians have got is, while they're not as adaptable, as innovative as the Ukrainians, they have demonstrated a real capacity to actually then turn what they have learned into lessons that can be learned at an industrial scale. So the Russians may well be lagging, shall we say, on the battlefield and in the innovation race. But on the other hand, so far, and again, the Ukrainians are doing what they can to catch up, so far, the Russians have been winning the battle, shall we say, in the industrial space.
Just the capacity to put the stuff in production once you know you need it.
Exactly.
Rebecca, are the Americans taking notice of how the war has been fought?
Absolutely. Well, at a micro level, I'd say the view from Washington is that Ukraine isn't losing, but it also isn't winning, which leads the expectation that the war is not going to end anytime soon. There's also been a lot of discussion amongst the defense community here in Washington about what the U.S. military, what NATO, what allies and partners should all be learning from the innovation that we're seeing on the battlefield in Ukraine. I would also say at the strategic level that analysts in the United States are looking to the full trajectory of the war in Ukraine to try to understand the shape of wars of the future. This is actually the first conflict since the end of the Soviet Union in which the United States and another major nuclear power have been on opposing sides of a conflict, albeit indirectly. And that has taught us important lessons about deterrence, about escalation management, all of which could be relevant in a future NATO-Russia conflict, but also in a potential conflict with China over Taiwan.
Let's talk a bit about manpower. It is incredible to most of us to think about how many people, soldiers, have been lost in the course of this war. Mark, in the first instance, can you tell us about the Russian manpower situation, since their losses have obviously been significantly greater?
Roughly speaking, they're losing between 30 and 35,000 dead or wounded per month. But they are also able to recruit a similar number. I mean, this is very much a poor man's war. They are managing to recruit from the more impoverished parts of the Russian Federation by offering what for them are life-altering sums of money. Now, ultimately, that pool of recruits will be drained, both because there just simply aren't enough people around, but also, frankly, the Russian state treasury is no longer going to be able to afford to offer these salaries and these benefits, including death benefits. But at present, they are managing to support this war.
Jack, how do you see this manpower question?
The interesting thing about the Russian force is that they take very, very heavy casualties, but the casualties are concentrated in this relatively thin assault layer of what they, broadly speaking, treat as disposable troops. And so while the Russians have been improving the performance of their artillery, their drone operators, their command and control, their electronic warfare officers, their air defense troops, and there's been relatively limited attrition among those forces, their assault troops, which represent about 30% of their line units, just get expended until they die. The unit then gets rotated off the front and it gets topped up with these recruits that Mark was talking about, who get between 3 days and 2 weeks of training and then just wasted again. And the remarkable thing is that even though this has led to the Russians continuously underperforming against their own anticipated timeline for operations, they haven't decided to correct the training or to move away from this model. It's a pretty close-run thing at the moment between casualties and recruitment. On the Ukrainian side, Ukrainian casualty figures are classified and they have not been shared. And the Ukrainians have done a good job of keeping those figures non-public. The Ukrainians suffer heavily in this war as well. And it's the hidden side of the conflict that Ukrainian losses are very high. I can't give the numbers, but there's been a discussion of a manpower crisis in the Ukrainian army for a long time.
Chris and Mark, I want to look a bit now at the civilian world in both Ukraine and Russia. Chris, one of the things that's been happening this winter is these significant Russian attacks on Ukrainian energy infrastructure. Now, you've actually lived through this. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's been like and what the impact has been on civilian morale?
Yeah, it's been awful. These relentless missile and drone attacks have taken out much of Ukraine's power generation capacity. That has meant that amid freezing temperatures, the coldest, harshest winter in more than a decade, millions of people have been without electricity, heating, in some places even without water. The city here in Kyiv has opened these what they call invincibility centers where people can go and sleep or charge their devices and warm up in tents that they've pitched in courtyards. People are going without those utilities for days or even several weeks. I live in a part of town where fortunately I've had power much of the time, but I haven't had heating for much of the last 2 months. I've been fortunate to have water. So imagine, you know, not having those utilities in temperatures that have plunged as low as minus 30 on
minus
occasion.
Minus 30. And sort of
minus 30 on some days.
So how do you survive minus 30 without any power?
In layers upon layers upon layers, people are boiling water and putting it into metal and plastic jugs and sticking it in their trousers or in their jackets to keep warm, you know, in these sort of makeshift hot water bottles.
What impact has that had on morale?
It's taken a real toll. People are exhausted. And now they've really gotten to the point where they're fed up with being told by their partners in the West, well done, you're so strong, you know, and resilient, hang in there. And they're at the point where they're saying, we're not broken, but we're reaching that point. You know, we're almost at a breaking point. We need your help. We need you to step up and do a lot more because they're facing extreme exhaustion.
Mark, what about the circumstances for ordinary Russians?
What the Russians are facing are two key pressures. I mean, one is obviously the impact of the casualties, 1.2 and upwards million dead and wounded. But in some ways, unless you happen to be from one of the regions where these people are disproportionately drawn or whether you're related to one, in some ways that still seems a rather distant thing. The main effect is absolutely on ordinary Russians. And just as this is a war of attrition on the front line, in some ways for Russians, it's a slow war of attrition on their quality of life rather than something that suddenly hits dramatically. Inflation at the moment, it's still around 6%, which is in some ways a kind of a tax on everyone's incomes because it's outstripping overall salary increases. The base rate for lending is 15.5%, which is very high, and particularly that's crippling for the civilian economy.
Rebecca Listener, I think it's time now to come to the question of diplomacy and particularly where America stands in terms of diplomacy, because it still appears to be America that's taking the lead on the diplomatic front. Can you take us through what the latest is on American diplomacy? Who's doing it, what they're doing, and how well it's going?
President Trump's policy towards the Russia-Ukraine war has been nothing short of a roller coaster over the past 13 months or so. And it's important to remember that it was almost exactly a year ago that President Trump hosted President Zelensky in the Oval Office for that now infamous meeting in which the president and the U.S. Vice President, J.D. Vance, really dressed down President Zelensky in front of the press. But in the intervening year, we've seen a few important dynamics that have crystallized and have gotten us to where we are today. You know, the first one is that President Zelensky and the Ukrainians have just gotten a lot better at managing the Trump administration. Second, you've seen the Europeans finding a way to walk the U.S. and walk President Trump back from the brink, avoiding Trump forcing a bad deal on Ukraine and coming up with their own coalition of the willing concept. And then the third dynamic that we've seen is just that Putin himself has shown that he does not really want to make a deal, or at least not a version of a deal that is realistically on the table. And so that has brought us to the present period where we do see now direct talks, several rounds of them between the United States or representatives of the United States, Russia, and Ukraine. And above all, it just comes down to the question of territory. Putin continues to demand that Ukraine cede the remainder of the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine. And those kinds of territorial concessions, which go beyond where the current line of contact is and would require Ukraine to give up the roughly 20% of the Donetsk region that it continues to control, are simply not palatable for the Ukrainians. And so Zelensky has put on the table the possibility of, for example, a demilitarized zone in which both sides would pull back in Donetsk, but Putin has not taken that deal. And so we remain stuck.
Jack Watling, the other big element always in the question about peace talks were about the security guarantees. In other words, whenever you've agreed a peace with Russia, how do you stop the Russians just regrouping and coming back for you again in the future? Could you just take us through where we've got to on the question of security guarantees and what you understand to be Ukraine's position on it?
So there's a coalition of the willing in Europe, of European states who've said they will put troops into Ukraine at the point when a ceasefire is declared. In many ways, that discourages the Russians from coming to a deal because the Russians don't want them there. Because the Russians, if they do have a ceasefire, want to continue to coerce Ukraine and switch to unconventional operations and the threat of reinvasion. The US has said that it might offer security guarantees to Ukraine if they agree to withdraw from the territory. There are two problems with that. The first is that everything else that the Trump administration has been doing makes everyone rather skeptical that he would actually honor that if the Russians were to breach their end of the bargain. And the other issue is that for the Ukrainians to withdraw from the 20% of Donbass that remains would mean to abandon all of the trench positions and fortifications and complex terrain that exists there, including urban terrain, and move into, broadly speaking, flat, open ground with no defenses. And so they would be extremely vulnerable if, during the process of withdrawal, the Russians were to claim that there had been various, you know, units that had been too slow or were deliberately holding out or whatever, and it breaks down. And actually, it creates a huge military opportunity for the Russians. So there's this point of maximum vulnerability. And then it's simply just politically not very acceptable to the Ukrainians to give this up. So the security guarantee question is, you know, what's on the table is either absolutely unacceptable to the Russians, not credible from the US, and tactically very, very dangerous for the Ukrainian military in the details of implementation.
So, Chris and Mark, the difficulty here is imagining any kind of diplomatic solution which one side would accept and that the other would also accept. So I imagine, Chris, that's still the position, that there isn't a Russian, current Russian position or imaginable Russian position that Ukraine can buy.
No, not under the current circumstances. I mean, Zelensky has said that himself. I just saw him on Monday and he reiterated that. His negotiating team has said that as well, that they remain at an impasse, that this major issue, predominantly of territory, and that includes not only the remainder of the Donbass or Donetsk Oblast that is under Ukrainian control, but also the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant that the Russians control in the south, which is the biggest such power plant in Europe, by the way. There is this idea by the Americans that they could control it or own the plant and then sell power to the Russians and the Ukrainians. Neither side finds that acceptable. So it's not just about land. It's also about control of this plant.
Mark, is there any position which Putin would be prepared to accept which would be remotely acceptable to the Ukrainians? And I suppose another way of asking that is he actually particularly interested in reality in a diplomatic process that will end the war?
Yeah, that's the difficult one because, you know, if we're absolutely honest, we don't know. I think the bottom line is that he has convinced himself that he is, however slowly and painfully, winning. And that he can win. Now, essentially, you know, from his point of view, he doesn't have to fight a forever war. He just needs to be able to fight for a week or a month longer than Ukraine can, and that Ukraine's European backers feel that they can afford to spend. So I think from his point of view, he's more or less regarding himself as being in a win-win position. If he gets something through the peace talks, well and good. But on the other hand, he's perfectly comfortable with the idea at the moment of walking away if need be. and actually thinking that, yes, maybe it'll take him another couple of years to grind his way through to be able to say, I have freed all of the Donbass region and all the Russian speakers there who are being oppressed by those dastardly neo-Nazis in Kyiv, all the propaganda lines, you know, these people are now safe. So I think from his point of view, this is the trouble. He is not desperate for a deal, and therefore he's not inclined to make the kind of concessions that really would help to make any kind of deal palatable to Ukraine.
I just want to ask each of you a very quick final question. If I ask you to think about the situation in 2 years' time, looking into those kind of cloudy crystal balls, would you bet that the war would still be continuing, or would you bet that it will be over? Rebecca?
It's always dangerous to make predictions amidst the fog of war, but I think more likely than not, the war is still continuing in some form 2 years from now. It's possible that 2 years from now, there will have been a ceasefire that stalled or broke down in implementation and led to some kind of resumption in violence. It's also possible that there's no ceasefire and the war is ongoing. It may not be at the same level of intensity that we see now, but that at some level of violence, there is a line of contact where forces are exchanging fire and Ukraine doesn't have the sense of security, let alone territorial integrity, that it had before Russia's full-scale invasion 4 years ago.
Jack, what do you think?
I think this phase of high-intensity combat will be over by then, but in terms of being in a fairly vicious confrontation with Russia, that will continue.
Mark?
Yes, I don't think this war can continue for 2 years. So either we will have some kind of peace. And it's worth noting that the French elections next year could actually have some fairly devastating implications for continued European support for Ukraine. But if there is no peace agreement, then absolutely there will be this kind of downshifting of the war that Jack mentioned, not least because the Russians can't keep up the current model of manning their war.
Chris, what do you think?
I agree with a lot of that. I think what we're likely to see is some type of new phase where the hot war ends. You know, in 2 years' time, it is possible that we see a ceasefire that lasts just long enough, possibly for Ukraine to hold elections. And that could be decisive in the war, in the sense that if it does get really ugly, if these campaigns bring out real recriminations, that could work in Russia's favor. And it's certainly of great concern here in Ukraine.
And that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Christopher Miller, Rebecca Lister, Jack Watling, and Mark Galliotti. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey and Kirsteen Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill. And the editor was Richard Varden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Ever wondered why America acts the way it does on the world stage? From Understand from BBC Radio 4 comes a new series exploring US foreign policy in five doctrines. We're telling the story of five big ideas that changed everything, from the Monroe Doctrine to Donald Trump. How did these doctrines shape the world we live in now, and what do they tell us about what's happening in America today? Listen on BBC Sounds.